Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon. Many of us, I'm sure, in this podcast audience have heard the name C.S. Lewis. It's pretty hard to avoid it. And I think in these discussions of Mormonism, and especially Mormonism that relates to critical thought and theology, C.S. Lewis is a huge name, a public intellectual of the 20th century, a great author. Probably a lot of us, it was The Chronicles of Narnia or some of his other fiction that maybe was the first thing that we read and that brought him into our consciousness. But there's been this interesting relationship with Mormonism and C.S. Lewis. Some have said that Lewis is almost like an honorary Mormon. He gets quoted, it seems like, in general conference, and you'll see in Ensign articles and things like that. And I think it's sort of an interesting relationship that Mormonism has with C.S. Lewis and his thought. And some I know are critical of it. They'll say that, oh, we're just trying to grab onto his cachet, you know, ride his coattails a little bit and sound more respectable in our own theology today. So that'll be a piece of our discussion. But really what I'm hoping to do, and I'm excited to have the panel that we do, is to introduce this fellow, get a sense of his life, get a sense of the scope of his writings, get a sense of how much he has been used and in what ways in Mormonism and how he's become part of the LDS discussion. And then all of us on this panel have an affection and an affinity for his writings. And so we're going to share some things towards the end about our own views and how he's helped us in our spiritual journeys and the different things that he's written that continue to play good parts in our lives. That is our plan for today, and I'm thrilled to have back on the show. I always tend to introduce my guests in terms of how many times they've been on. So we're going to go back with Katie Langston as our most experienced Mormon Matters guest. Would you introduce yourself again?
Sure. Hello. Thank you. It's always fun to be on Mormon Matters. My name is Katie Langston, and I am currently a content development strategist, which means I write stuff for people that goes on the internet. But I'm excited to say that in the next couple years, I'll be making a bit of a career transition. This fall, I will be I was just accepted to graduate school, so I will be studying, getting dual master's degrees in marriage and family therapy and theology. And I'm super stoked about that. And I'm a big C.S. Lewis fan and a theology nerd, so always fun to be here.
Yeah. And tell everybody the name of the blog that you work on.
Oh, yes, that's right. I blog I blog for Doves and Serpents, and then I have another blog that I run called Into the Hills. And Into the Hills itself is a reference to C.S. Lewis, The Great Divorce. The premise of The Great Divorce is that a bunch of people from hell take a bus ride up to the outskirts of heaven, and they're in a meadow that kind of, you know, leads into the great hills beyond. And so transformation comes for the people who are damned if they choose to by taking those first kind of painful steps into the hills. So it's sort of a metaphor for spiritual growth and development and stuff like that. So
perfect. Thanks so much. And we're excited to hear from you today.
Thanks.
Blair, you've been on once before. This is Blair Hodges, everyone. Would you remind everybody a little bit about yourself?
Thanks for having me on again. I'm Blair Hodges, and I'm finishing up a master's degree at Georgetown University in religious studies. My family and I moved back to Utah so that I could start work here. I got a job with the Neil A. Maxwell Institute at BYU. I'm their public communications specialist, and you know, I became familiar with C.S. Lewis on my mission. My mission president gave me permission to read Screwtape Letters, and so from then on, I read the when I got home, I read his other fiction books, The Chronicles of Narnia, and then his Perelandra series. And then as I was finishing up my minor in religious studies at the U, I read through the collected letters of C.S. Lewis and found a recurring theme in there was this idea of what to do with good people who weren't Christians. And to see him wrestle with that question theologically in his letters, I found that that would be an interesting thing to compare with Joseph Smith's answer to that question. So that was the project that I did. And as a side project, I looked into Mormon usage of C.S. Lewis and all that sort of stuff. And I think we'll talk about that later on. So that's my familiarity with C.S. Lewis.
Awesome. Thanks so much. And interesting, your new job. This is quite an interesting time to be at the Maxwell Institute.
Yeah, I'm really excited. We have some really exciting announcements that'll be coming out in the next couple weeks here. And yeah, I'm really excited to be there.
Good. Well, we'll look forward to having someone there that we can get the straight scoop from. So thanks.
Yeah.
No, I just tease it a little bit. A little truthful, a little tease. No, but thank you very much,
Well,
Claire.
Guess what I heard. No, I'm
just... Yeah. Anyway, so great to have you, and thank you for being
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
Well, Hanrai Stewart, thrilled to have you. I met you 6 months ago when you gave a talk on C.S. Lewis at the Springville Library in Springville, Utah. And I know you're from Arizona and a playwright. And give us the whole rundown and especially your C.S. Lewis connections.
Yeah, again, I'm Hanrai Stewart. I am currently at Arizona State University getting my MFA in dramatic writing. So that's playwriting and screenwriting. C.S. Lewis has had a huge impact on my life. Ever since I was a kid when I started reading the Chronicles of Narnia, and then in high school I went into a C.S. Lewis binge where I just read tons and tons and tons of Lewis, especially after I encountered some of his poetry. I was in a kind of an angsty poetry stage early high school and ran across some of his poetry, and he really influenced my religious thinking that way, and my religion started being incorporated into my writing at that point. I wrote a play called Swallow the Sun, which is based on C.S. Lewis's early life, mainly in his 20s, 20s to 30s, when he was an atheist for quite a while, and then came back to Christianity and became the most reluctant convert in all of England, as he put it.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's again, mainly a playwright, working on screenwriting as well. Swallow the Sun just got optioned for a film, so we're hoping that will actually get made. Lightstone Pictures is currently drumming up funding, and so hopefully that will be made this summer, cross my fingers. So
cool. And I heard maybe one of your future projects will be another C.S. Lewis, more of his interactions with the Inklings.
Yeah, I'm hoping to write that play before too long, especially his interaction with J.R.R. Tolkien and Charles Williams. There was an interesting interplay happening between those three at one point, where he was becoming a little more distant with Tolkien, who had been his friend for a long time, and then he becoming more friendly with Charles Williams, and their ideas seemed to bounce off each other. And he took a lot of inspiration from him, which Tolkien didn't actually like. He wasn't a big fan of Williams. And so there was drama has conflict, and that had plenty of personal conflict. It was interesting. So
cool. Well, I will look forward to that too, and we'll get links to where people can read the play and all that stuff, and the fundraising for the film. So we'll make sure to put those links up on the site. We, kind of ahead of time, everyone, just agreed to have Mahanrai take off this beginning section and be our lead to encapsulate the arc of C.S. Lewis's life and the importance and whatever he would like to share. So let's just get familiar or re-familiar with him.
Okay, so C.S. Lewis, a lot of people don't focus on his author's childhood, but with C.S. Lewis, that would be a mistake. When he was a child, he and his brother Warney would play together and would sit in their family's wardrobe and make up these worlds about this place called Boxen, about kind of anthropomorphic animals walking around and signing peace treaties and whatnot. And at the time, it was more copying very much adult things with almost political kind of things. Very intellectual little kids.
Right.
So he had this really imaginative childhood, but still kind of wanting to be an adult. And when he became an adult, he kind of wanted to be a child again, kind of an interesting little loop there. And then he went on, but one of the most tragic aspects of his childhood was when his mother died from cancer. And that had a devastating effect on him and eventually influenced his choice to go into atheism. There was a lot of emotional pain there, and his father sent him and his brother Warney off to school, to an institution that would have made the Brontes shudder. You know, it was, if you read his autobiography about his early life, Surprised by Joy, he gives a pretty vivid description of it and his experience there, and it was a very, very difficult time in his life. And so the universe seemed to be closing in around him. He lost his faith eventually and became a pretty entrenched atheist.
Do you want to go ahead and offer some of the pieces of his interest in mythology and the occult,
yeah,
and things like that that sort of led to his, you know, because he's raised a Christian. I don't know that it was, you know, super, super religious home, but, you know, there would be no reason to doubt sort of what you're swimming in. And then he kind of came to these studies.
And that's the thing about C.S. Lewis, is he was this romantic. You know, he loved the romantic poets. He loved mythology. He was especially fond of Norse mythology. And he had a friend, Arthur Greaves. Arthur was kind of an imaginary invalid. You know, his parents sheltered him and protected him. But Arthur was a Christian. And so they'd have these discussions about religion a lot. And sometimes Jack could be he went by Jack, by the way, when he was young. He declared to his family, "I'm Jaxie," because he hated the name Clive. And so I don't blame him. Although
Jaxie was his dog who died, right?
Jaxie. He called himself Jaxie. And
I thought he declared himself that after his dog Jaxie died.
I didn't know that.
Oh, okay. Well, and maybe I'm remembering wrong, but it was like he was so sad, and so he just says, and he refused to answer to anything but Jaxie, right?
He wouldn't go by Clive ever again, you know.
Right,
and
right.
So for the rest of his life, he was Jack. But so when he established this friendship with Arthur Greaves, and they would write lots of letters back and forth, and talk a lot about religion. Blair, it seems like you noted Arthur a little bit in your essay, didn't you?
Yeah, his friend Arthur Greaves. They had an extensive correspondence as well. They wrote to each other pretty often when they were both young, and Lewis would often give him a hard time about Christianity specifically, you know, because of his love of myths and that sort of thing. He kind of just put Christianity in that same conceptual container and
exactly,
gave his buddy a hard time about it.
And that idea of the myth and what would later he would term as the true myth, because of Tolkien's influence, was a very important concept with him. Mythology just runs rampant throughout his life. And whether it's Norse mythology or Greek mythology, I mean, you just have to look no farther than the Chronicles of Narnia or his best book, Till We Have Faces, just to realize how important mythology was to him. So he and Arthur had this strong friendship, but kind of combative friendship at one point. And the irony is that Jack came into Christianity, and then Arthur eventually left it. And so they made a bit of a reversal there, where and I've always seen Arthur as kind of he was pampered. He was pampered by his parents. He was pampered in his life. Well, Jack had the hard knocks. And so Jack, through that crucible of experience, came closer to God, and Arthur became more distant because of that easy road, if that makes sense. At least that's how I view it. That might be improving my worldview on that.
Now, just before you leave the mythology thing, so maybe that you were already going to go here, but let's make sure you do. When he says the true myth versus the other myths, maybe let's just nail it down a little bit firmer than that. He's basically saying, in all these other myths, we see gods who die and resurrect, or we see gods that do the basic same things that we say Jesus did. Therefore, why am I to believe the Jesus one any more than the other? Is that a pretty fair characterization?
Yeah, exactly. Whether it was Osiris or Prometheus or Balder, you know, you've got this resurrecting myth, and almost a Joseph Campbell reoccurring myth through history. And he says this Christianity might have a lot of things going for it, but originality is not one of them.
Right.
And so that kind of stuck into his head, and that was his main argument for a long time. But eventually, later down the road, J.R.R. Tolkien, famously the author of Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, and Hugo Dyson were strong influences on that idea of the true myth. There was this one, C.S. Lewis had been due to some other friends and some other influences, especially Owen Barfield and others, had really nailed him and challenged him so that his concepts weren't so arrogant, and he had a search and he had a cry, and he slowly started becoming a deist and having these experiences. And especially after the death of his father, Albert, after the death of his mother, there was an estranged relationship between him and his father for a very long time. And C.S. Lewis had a thing against Freud, but a lot of his life was very Freudian, you know, where this separation from the father, the death of the mother, I mean, the separation from the mother, the love for the mother, all these kind of things play into his life. But then he, after his father's death, he felt his father's presence, he says, and had this really spiritual connection and supernatural thing happened to him, which he couldn't explain. And so that was another peg along the journey. But he started meeting with Tolkien and Hugo Dyson. Hugo Dyson was a Shakespearean scholar at Reading. And then Gerald Tolkien was teaching at Oxford, which C.S. Lewis was eventually teaching at as well, at the Magdalen College. And so they were having a discussion one night. They'd been meeting a long time about with a group called the Cold Biters, reading Old Norse myths to each other and original Norse. You know, and they were very nerdy in their interest of old mythology. And you just have to read Lord of the Rings to know how Tolkien was into that too. They were having this really kind of intimate talk, and they were walking in the woods, and Tolkien and Dyson were really challenging him and about this idea of there being a true myth, that Christ is all those myths incarnate, that then this was very purposeful, that this pattern wasn't accidental, that there's some kind of pre-existent memory just dislodged in our brains. I mean, and I'm putting my own words in this, but this is the concept generally. And that all these things were signposts leading to Christ. And so after that talk, that really kind of rattled and affected Lewis. Katie, there's this beautiful moment that reminds me of The Great Divorce, where he's on a bus. And so that bus imagery is, I think, very purposeful in that book. But he's on a bus, and he feels like he's becoming really vulnerable before God, and that he has to take off this armor before God and become really, really vulnerable. And he has this beautiful moment on the bus where he changes directions and goes to heaven instead of hell, metaphorically, you know. And so I think that really influenced Great Divorce a lot. But because you mentioned interest in that book, that's one of my favorites too.
Great Divorce. Mine, it's totally mine.
It's between that and Till We Have Faces for me.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I think Till We Have Faces jumps on top for me, but Great Divorce is just a little below that.
Yeah.
And so he has this moment where he becomes the most reluctant convert of all of England, and then he goes on a bus ride with his brother Warnie, and they're going to the zoo with
it's actually motorcycle.
Oh, I meant motorcycle.
That's right, the sidecar, yep.
Yeah, so sidecar motorcycle, and he accuses Warnie of annihilating space. He's just, you know, it's on this motorcycle. And they're going with Mrs. Moore and her daughter, Maureen, who he'd been living with for a number of years. And there's some speculation about those two, which we might go into later. But between the bus ride and the zoo, he feels his conversion happen. He talks about leaving a deist and arriving a Christian and not quite knowing how. But something happened to him on that little motorcycle ride. I think it's very interesting that he ends up at a zoo at the end.
Yeah, yeah, with all the
They even make this joke about Mr. Boltitude, a bear at the zoo, who ends up being a character in his space trilogy. And then, of course, Aslan and Narnia just conjures images of that. I just think that's very beautiful.
Yeah. Now, this ride to the zoo was from deism, so go back, you kind of mentioned just in passing that phrase about being the most reluctant Christian in the universe. Kind of take us back to read us that whole quote, or give us that whole quote, because I think it's a fascinating one. It's like, I'm being stalked by this God and I do not want to meet him. You know, in other words, I love it. Just go for it.
Wondering if I have the quote in front of me or not. Do you, Blair? Or Dan?
Yes, here. Picture me alone in that room, night after night, feeling. Whenever my mind lifted, even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him who I so earnestly desired not to meet. I gave in and admitted that God was God, and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England.
And it's such a great image, you know.
That's we forget that about him, especially with Lewis. His conversion wasn't this progressive struggle of his own efforts to intellectually achieve certainty about Christianity. He felt, especially in retrospect, that it was this something that came up from behind and sort of took over his heart. And, you know, that's how he depicted conversion, as this God emerging within him sort of a thing.
Almost in a sneaky way, as I recall. It was like, you know, I remember in Surprised by Joy when he makes allusions to how God had laid his trap, I think is how he says it, which is just a really fascinating
way. He says that, and then he goes on to say that to other people, too. He's receiving letters from Sheldon von Aachen, who is a great author, and he's worried that he's converting to Christianity, and Lewis is responding with, like, I think the Holy Ghost the Holy Spirit has you in his net. You can't get away, you know.
Well, and there was a great line. I think you quoted it, Blair, in your piece about where he's writing to Owen Barfield. And Barfield, you've mentioned him before, and he's one of my favorite guys. This whole second friend stuff would be worth doing a portion of a podcast on what it means to be the second friend. But Barfield was the spiritualist. He writes to Barfield. He goes, "The spirit, it's showing an alarming tendency to become much more personal, and it's taking the offensing and is behaving just like God. You better come on Monday at the latest, or I may have entered a monastery." You know, so it's just this great line of, like, this is just happening to me, and I don't know what's going on, but it is strong.
Well, I think it's important to note the effect spiritualism had on him, where this kind of the dark spiritual side of things was a bit of a lure to him. He says at one point he would have been very tempted to become a wizard, you know, and that. And you could get a sense of that in books like Prince Caspian, when you've got the hag and the werewolf, and offering this kind of dark knowledge, this dark spirituality. And he had a friend, John Doc Askins. They called him Doc, who was the brother of Mrs. Moore, and he was very much into the spiritualism and into this this really darker side of things. And him and Owen Barfield was a little more lighter than that. Doc got into kind of the astral planing, kind of that kind of really supernatural, edgy kind of spirituality. And but he eventually went crazy, and he was writhing on the floor like a lunatic. And him and Mrs. Moore had to contain him and pull him down and contain him. And he was like that for days, and just writhing like a lunatic. And he eventually died. And that really, really rattled Jack. And he says, oh, back to the humdrum, back to the normal day-to-day, ho-hum kind of life. That's what's for me. This supernatural stuff is a little too real. And so you've got
It should. The doctor, he'd also been in war, too.
Lewis
tries to say that he had had war. He was having war flashbacks. It's clear now. And I mean, he was suffering from PTSD is what was going on. And it, you know, he just descended into this lunatic sort of state.
But I think it's interesting. There's been a few people, famous people who were involved in spiritualism who had a similar fate. Mary Todd Lincoln, David Harm Smith, the son of Joseph Smith and Emma. He got involved in spiritualism on his missions to Utah for the RLDS Church. And similar thing happened to him, where he just becomes a raving lunatic eventually. Obviously, that's the clinical kind of things have an impact, but I don't discount the spiritual aspect and the literal possible demons that were infesting these great minds at the time. But I mean, again, that's me putting my own worldview onto that. So
okay, so we've got Lewis now, he's up to the point where he reluctantly became a theist. He felt like he was being pursued and stalked by God. The spirit's coming after him. And now he's had the, now he's had this moment on the way to the
one,
zoo.
One other thing, too, is he'd also known several other hard-boiled atheists, he calls them, who had also converted. And every single time it happened, it would frighten him. Like, what's happening? What are all these people doing?
So that if was they're another, vulnerable to this, what's gonna, yeah. Yeah, how can I resist it, too? Yeah, I kind of remember some of that language, too. Definitely. So, okay, he's now a Christian, though, and, you know, he's by this point, he's established it at Oxford, and he just begins, is it the Space Trilogy that he writes first?
No, it's the Pilgrim's Regress.
That's right, yeah.
Yes, 1933, yeah. Kind of a take on Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress.
And he's written things before this, Dimer, which is kind of an epic poem, and some early poetry. He'd originally wanted to be a poet.
Yeah, he wrote a book, and it wasn't very good. It didn't do well. It didn't sell.
But he got good reviews. Book of poetry. Yeah. But his father says he got good reviews.
Yeah. He didn't respect his dad, by the way. I should add that, too. His dad was sort of a bumbling Christian, I think.
Yeah, but I think at the end of his life, there was a reconciliation there.
Certainly.
His father helped pay him for their school, despite their problematic relationship. His father was always supportive of getting him through Oxford and paying for his education just all along the way. He had a great tutor called the Great Knock and whatnot. So we've got Lewis writing The Pilgrim's Regress, and it's very autobiographical. It's a really interesting book. I really like it. In fact, there's this moment which he uses in there. I've got a quote here where he's quoting about his childhood. Again, this kind of relates back to his childhood. And as a young man in this book, John, the protagonist, he grows up religious, but he kind of sees the false, almost Pharisee-like aspect of what organized religion was to their world. But then he has this something which C.S. Lewis calls joy or longing, or it's an important aspect of his spirituality in his life. And he says, "Then came the sound of a musical instrument. From behind, it seemed very sweet and very short, as if it were one plucking of a string or one note of a bell, and after it a full, clear voice, and it sounded so high and strange that he thought it was very, very far away, further than a star. The voice said, 'Come.' Then John saw that there was a stone wall beside the road in that part, but it had what he had never seen in a garden wall before, a window. There was not glass in the window and no bars. It was a square hole in the wall. Through it, he saw green wood of primroses, and he remembered suddenly how he had gone into another wood to pull primroses as a child, very long ago, so long that even in the moment of remembering, the memory seemed still out of reach. While he strained to grasp it, there came to him from beyond the wood a sweetness and pang so piercing that instantly he forgot his father's house and his mother and the fear of the landlord and the burden of the rules. All the furniture of his mind was taken away. A moment later, he found that he was sobbing, and the sun had gone in. And what it was that had happened to him, he could not quite remember, nor whether it had happened in this wood or in the other wood when he was a child. It seemed to him that a mist which hung at the far end of the wood had parted for a moment, and through the rift he had seen a calm sea, and in the sea an island, where the smooth turf sloped downward unbroken to the bays, and out of the thickets peeped the pale, small-breasted oreads, wise like gods and conscious of themselves like beasts, and tall enchanters, bearded to their feet, sat in the green chairs among the forests." And so he has this joy, this longing, this ache, which needs to be filled. And he first describes having this feeling when he was a child with Warney, his brother, again. And Warney had brought him this little garden in a biscuit tin. And even though it was this little manufactured little piece of dirt, basically, it caused him such wonder and ache and longing that he couldn't quite pinpoint it. And he felt a similar thing when he read Fantasties by George MacDonald, which was a huge impact on him. He says it baptized his imagination. Blair, you're familiar with George MacDonald. I'm not sure if you are Katie or not. But can you?
Well, he's the main character in The Great Divorce.
Yeah, besides, Great Divorce.
So.
George MacDonald was a clergyman and an author, sort of like Lewis, but and he had a sort of a universalist streak in him. He didn't mind bucking thought about, you know, his atonement theory was a little bit more radical than some of the other ministers. And then he wrote these works of fiction designed for children. And yeah, Lewis by happenstance picked, how did you pronounce it? Fantasties?
Fantasties? I don't know what that
is. Fantasties?
P-H-A-N-T-A-S-I-E-S, yeah, or whatever. Yeah, I don't know how to say it either.
E-E-S, it's some weird thing. But anyway, yeah, it's this great, it's a great little story, a children's story that's got all the, you know, it's a little bit magical and everything. And a little bit like the Narnia books. And,
yeah, I wouldn't even call it a children's story. That one was really...
Oh, it's good enough for, yeah, it's good enough for us, I'm saying. But, you know, he intended it as a children's book that could appeal to adults as well. And that's, you know...
Yeah, and it was just happenstance at a train station or something that he picked it up when he was 16. Yeah. And just kind of really sent him on a neat segment of his life.
When I read the book, I felt something similar, I think. There was such yearning in there, and there was such ache and such like you're longing for a different world almost. And it was hard to describe how that book made me feel too, where it's like, whoa, C.S. Lewis was right. You know, this is great. But that yearning, that joy, he called it.
And it's Lewis said MacDonald influenced him more than anybody else, bar none.
Didn't he call him master even?
Yeah.
And referred to him as his master, didn't he?
Yeah. Right.
MacDonald being his rabbi sounds very, very appropriate. But yeah, huge. And Tolkien liked him too. That whole group of Inklings, which is probably a good segue. The Inklings, eventually, they started again as the Coalbiters, him and some others, him, Tolkien, and Hugo Dyson, a Shakespearean scholar. And then eventually they kind of morphed into the Inklings. And so they had these, they'd get out their pipes and their beer, and they would discuss each other's work. It's interesting how they respond to each other's work. Tolkien was very critical of the Chronicles of Narnia. He thought they were kind of derivative, and the whole Father Christmas thing just boggled his mind. He's like, why are you putting Santa Claus in here? Well, it seems like Charles Williams was a little more supportive of Lewis's efforts in that direction, and even how he influenced the Space Trilogy. By the end, I can't even remember. But the last book in the Space Trilogy is very different tone.
The Hideous Strength?
Hideous Strength, yep. And it has a very different tone, has a very different feel than the rest of his books. And it seems to be attributed to Charles Williams's books. His were kind of more of that kind of supernatural mystery, almost a little more earthy kind of style.
And then he brought like Merlin and stuff into it. I liked the trilogy, but I thought the third book kind of went off the rails a bit. But that's just
Tolkien would agree with you. I kind of like it. I think it's interesting. I think there's some bizarre, interesting things happening in there, which is it's very different than the rest of his work. And so a lot of people don't like it. Yeah, but the Inklings were an important group. Tolkien kind of credited, I think, C.S. Lewis with helping him have the courage and the encouragement to finish Lord of the Rings and Hobbit. Because he'd been working on this whole world for who knows how long, and sometimes he was just willing, just wanting to throw up his arms and throw it all away. But C.S. Lewis really encouraged him in that. So we have C.S. Lewis to thank not only for his own work, but Tolkien's as well in some way. And Hugo Dyson didn't like a lot of the elements of the Lord of the Rings. Not Hugo Dyson. Hugo. Yeah, that's who I'm thinking of. Where he says no more, and then swears freaking elves, basically. And but they had their funny moments where they would clash a bit and disagree and argue, and it was great fun. So then we've got at near the end of his life, an important figure was Joy Gresham, or Joy Davidman. She was a divorcee Jewish former communist who was really impacted by C.S. Lewis's work.
And she's from New York, right?
Yeah, from New York, and so really brash American. If any of you have seen the movie Shadowlands or read the play or anything, it's beautiful. Although it takes some historical liberties, it's quite a beautiful work. It stars Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger. It's a great movie. And that impacts his theology in the sense when she eventually gets cancer and dies, and it's a huge impact on his life. And C.S. Lewis wrote two books about pain. The Problem of Pain, which is very intellectual, very from the head, and then A Grief Observed After When Joy Died, where he's dealing with it on a much more personal level. And so with A Grief Observed, it comes from a much more personal spot, and he's going through lots of doubt and lots of pain. And eventually, through the course of this, he's keeping this diary, and he didn't even publish under his name at first. But you get this really aching sense of this really hit him hard. The death of his wife really rattled him. And people like Tolkien had really opposed the marriage because she was a divorcee. And so Tolkien being a Catholic was really against divorce. And so he just saw it as theologically as an affair, basically, or being unfaithful. But C.S. Lewis took a different track eventually on that thought. And so in that moment, you get the contrast between the intellectual work of theology and the personal work of theology. Joy also really, he dedicates Till We Have Paces to her, which is his best book. So she had a huge impact on his life. And her twin sons, when she died, he helped raise them. And Douglas Gresham is now really involved in the Narnia movies and is carrying on his stepdad's work.
Well, that takes us, I think, through basically, you know, things that people have heard about and just touched on it. But I really want to just, let's get to his role as a Christian, a public intellectual, a defender of Christianity, sort of an ecumenical thinker. You and Blair maybe together, I want to hear about this towering figure that from the 50s, in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, this guy was a honking rock star.
Yeah, so Lewis, after his conversion, he starts to dialogue with his friends about Christianity, and then he kind of wants to try on the apologist's hat a little bit. And I think he was actually quite foolhardy when he began. He was invited by the BBC to give a series of radio talks, which eventually became the book Mere Christianity. And so he begins writing these radio talks, and he had the idea early on that he was going to just stick to the basics. He was going to appeal to Christians of all stripes. He was going to be very ecumenical. Tolkien was a Catholic. Lewis had become an Anglican, and they had friends of different from different Christian groups. And so he thought, well, I'm just going to appeal to everybody here. And he quickly discovered that was virtually impossible. But you can see in Mere Christianity his attempt to present the most ecumenical theology that he possibly could. And he recognized throughout his life that he was an amateur theologian, that he wasn't a systematic theologian. He certainly never claimed to be a deep theologian. Rather, he was a popular theologian. He could speak and write in a way that appealed to most people. He was very enjoyable to listen to. His prose is very readable, and he had a way of describing Christianity with using some new language that he didn't sound stodgy, and he didn't sound in context. He didn't sound so boring, I guess you could say. So the lectures themselves were a huge success, and that led to the book. And then from there, he kind of became publicly known as an apologist for Christianity for the rest of his life, not only publicly, but privately as well. He corresponded with hundreds of people that wrote to him. He made it a point daily to try to answer as many letters as he could. And so he also tried to personally minister to people as well as being a public intellectual.
Which is so impressive to me, where he, it was walking the walk with him in Christianity, you know, where he, it wasn't just the intellectual work, it wasn't just this, it was that personal touch with human beings, which, and children too, even though he didn't really have children, except for his stepchildren and his stepsons in his later life, where it being just all those letters to the children he wrote, and just nobody was beneath him. He was constantly reaching out to others who were reaching out to him.
Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, sometimes the letters kind of bothered him. You can tell in people that would repeatedly write him and sort of take advantage of his goodwill, he would start to try to drop hints like, hey, didn't you write me last Christmas? Like, you know. And like the Christmas before, one lady like wrote him every Christmas, and by the end of it, he's just like, how about we just make an agreement not to write during Christmas? You know?
Interesting.
But yeah, I agree. And he, even though he didn't have kids, he just had this way of writing to children. One of this letter to one of, I think to his nephew or something, said, I was walking down the path and I saw a rabbit and it winked at me. Can you believe that? You know, so he had this way of just bringing up these things that it's just, I don't know. He's just fun. Just a fun guy. But
I think he's drawing from his own childhood a lot right there, where he remembered his childhood vividly and it was a really important part of his life. And people would accuse him of not knowing any children. He said, well, I did know the child. I knew me and Warnie, you know, right. And he used that and he remembered that and it was impactful. And was it Beatrix Potter that he loved?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But those little magical moments from childhood would always kind of haunt him. And you kind of feel this longing that he wants to go back there. You know?
Yeah. And another thing I just want to add too, in addition to the childlikeness of some of his works, is just he was much more tentative in his personal letters than he was in his public talks and books, as far as allowing a lot of leeway for different Christian beliefs. There were a few things that he just couldn't countenance, but his thought developed, and I think we do him a disservice when we try to pin him down without kind of recognizing his own theological development. And even in some ways, some of his slipshod theological constructions. Again, he wasn't systematic. So, I see him more as a person to engage theological ideas rather than as someone who had a set theology that you could return to yourself.
Good, thanks. So let's not assume. So his famous books, we've got the Chronicles of Narnia. Those were a huge success. They're big. And that's tales of these children that go through a magical wardrobe into a land called Narnia. There's a lot of anthropomorphic animals and creatures and you know other beings there, and they have all these series of adventures. So it's 7 books. Other famous ones: Screwtape Letters. Who wants to describe that one?
The Screwtape Letters is a book of like fictitious letters from Screwtape to Wormwood. And so Screwtape is like a head demon and Wormwood is like a demon in training. And they have a patient, you know, which is their human subject that they're trying to tempt and lead down the road to hell. And so it's this sort of witty, biting, and I think profoundly insightful book that gets at the sort of nuances of evil and temptation and stuff like that.
Yeah, and just human nature, whether or not you ever have to put the satanic overlay onto it. You know, there's just a lot about anything that's good taken to excess is going to lead you to evil. And, you know, things like that are just really terrific insights. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, good. Then, of course, Mere Christianity, which we've mentioned, was big. Problem of Pain, Abolition of Man, all these different things. And then Till We Have Faces. Katie, I know you're going to talk about that.
Sure. Till We Have Faces is it's a novel, and I think it's probably his masterpiece. I might like The Great Divorce more, but I think Till We Have Faces is maybe more brilliantly done.
And Lewis cited it as his favorite too, where it was his
first
favorite of his books. Yeah.
Oh, cool. But it's a story, it's the retelling of the myth of Cupid and Psyche, but it's told from the story of Arul, who is Psyche's older sister, who in the myth, of course, is like a one-dimensional kind of bad character, but in the book comes alive as a three-dimensional living and breathing character for whom you find you have a lot of empathy. And the beginning of the book, or the first, you know, the first three-fourths of the book is written from the first-person perspective of Arul, who is writing a complaint against the gods, how the gods have wronged her, how they have, you know, they have never given her anything good, and how her life is a disaster because of them. And then at the end of the book, she has an epiphany and an experience meeting a god. This isn't the Christian god. These are, you know, it's mythology. She meets a god, and the end of the book is her changing her mind or looking back at her life with a completely different perspective before she, like, well, this is a spoiler, but before she drops dead. I don't know if you want to leave that in, but, like, that's... It's brilliant.
Yeah, it doesn't ruin it.
No, it's love. Yeah, you'll still go on quite a journey My sincerest apologies for spoilers, but
Well, cool. Well, so these are just huge. And, you know, when he would publish a book, it was an event. When he, you know, if he was going to go give a lecture, hundreds would show up. You know, I just don't think we have a concept in today's, you know, society to realize that intellectuals were, there were these public figures that could draw these huge crowds. And I don't know. I don't think there's anything that compares. I remember, you know, one of my favorite persons is William James. Whenever he would give lecture, and this is the turn of the century, you know, 1910, 1915 kind of stuff, thousands would want to come to hear him speak. And that was their entertainment. Now we have TV and internet and all that stuff, but these guys were huge. And so here's C.S. Lewis, and he's this well-known literary guy. He's got some philosophical background. He actually, at one point, was tempted to become a philosopher, but then he goes, I realized that, you know, like you said something early, Mahan, right? He liked the romantics. You know, he needed that. He needed something other than the pure analytic stuff. He needed hope and things. And so, but he had this training, and he was able to put, at a time when spirituality and stuff, you know, this is the middle of the modern era, you know, the spirituality is attacked on all sides, and he is able to stand up there, and this story of him being an atheist who became a deist and then a Christian, he fascinated people.
In the context of World War II being the background of the radio talks that became Mere Christianity, I think was huge. And the world was in an upheaval. Really, you know, I mean, just a world war, and people needed something like this to keep the faith.
Terrific. Good. Blair, I'm going to turn it to you to say, what was it that Mormons picked up on? How much did they pick up on it? Was he getting quoted left and right?
All right, so we'll start by just debunking a really common myth, and that's the idea that C.S. Lewis is the most quoted non-Mormon in General Conference, and that's actually not true. Mary Jane Woodger did a nice piece on this, and she found that Lewis wasn't the most quoted. It's actually, this will blow your mind, but it's Abraham Lincoln. He's the most quoted person in General Conference.
I'm mad that that myth isn't true. I believed it.
Yeah, well, it's not true.
My worldview is shattering.
I mean, it's not even close. Lewis is around, by my last count, it was 28, and that was a couple of years ago. And then, I mean, Lincoln's up in like 154 somewhere around there. So he's got a lot of catching up to do. But anyway, the first time that any Mormon publication referenced Lewis was actually Lewis Midgley, BYU professor at the time, and he did a BYU Studies essay called God and Immortality in Dostoevsky's Thought, and it had a footnote that referenced something that C.S. Lewis had written. So that was your first earliest known reference that I could find. And then from a general authority, it was 1961, Hubie Brown included a quote from C.S. Lewis in his book Continuing the Quest, and it was just – the end of the book just has kind of a bunch of quotes that he must have clipped from somewhere, and there's a short one there from Lewis. So that's the first couple references that you get. And then Richard L. Evans referred to him in a book called Faith in the Future. But you don't see him appearing in General Conference for a little bit later on. But BYU Studies, I should add, also published a few of Lewis's essays. They got permission to publish a couple of his essays in 1969 and 1972. So we were publishing full essays from Lewis in BYU Studies. Now, this is interesting. The first known reference to Lewis in an official LDS publication, so something put out by the church, was actually in the first issue of The New Era in January 1971. So that was when they redid all the magazines. They started The New Era as sort of the youth magazine, and Neil A. Maxwell wrote a piece in there in sort of a question and answer section of The New Era, and it was actually asking about the second coming of Jesus Christ, and he refers to a pithy line by Lewis to the effect that you know, you need to choose Christ before the second coming, because it will do you little good to kneel when it's no longer possible to stand, sort of a thing. So he's using some of Lewis's wordplay there. Now, the first time that Lewis was in General Conference, believe it or not, was in a talk by Paul Dunn. Let me see what year that was in. That was 6 years later. So it was 1977. It was a Paul Dunn talk. And then since then, he's been, you know, quoted in multiple General Conference addresses. Neil A. Maxwell definitely leads the pack as far as referring to C.S. Lewis or quoting C.S. Lewis. several.
They'll talk about C.S. Lewis, which at a C.S. Lewis symposium, which BYU put at one point, which was I think I attended that one, or maybe I just saw on video. But I attended parts of that symposium, and it was just a beautiful talk about discipleship and C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, Elder Maxwell is probably the chief promoter of C.S. Lewis going all the way back. I mean, even during the 1950s, before Lewis ever appeared in any LDS publication, he had read the Screwtape Letters and was so impressed with it that he sent Lewis a copy of the Book of Mormon with a letter of gratitude. And his biographer, Bruce C. Hafen, writes about this in Maxwell's biography. And I can actually quote the letter that he sent right here. He says, "May I express my deep appreciation for your contribution to literature and Christianity through your excellent writings. Your work has held special pleasure for me. Perhaps you do not realize you have acquired quite a following in this area of America," referring to Utah. And then he kind of described what the Book of Mormon was and said that, "My gratitude for your work is not conditioned upon your appreciation of this book. My sending it to you represents an effort to share with you some of the things that have brought me satisfaction as a token of the appreciation I feel for your writings." And I talked to Bruce Hafen about this to find out if Lewis ever responded, and Maxwell didn't mention whether he did or not. So Hafen kind of had the impression that he probably didn't answer. And in fact, Maxwell sent the book right at the end of November, and you might remember I mentioned Christmas time. That's when he received more mail than any other time of the year. So it's kind of an inopportune, he might not have even, well, he probably would have opened it, but as far as he didn't respond to all the letters that he got around Christmas time, that's just how it was. So, we know that Lewis did know about the Book of Mormon though. In fact, he mentioned the Book of Mormon in a 1950 lecture that he gave at the University of London. And he was talking about the literary impact of the authorized version of the Bible. And he was, surprised that version hadn't had a greater impact on the English language. And so he was talking about literary influence in general, like what has the Bible influenced. And he pointed to the Book of Mormon as an example of a book that had been influenced by the King James Version specifically. And he was talking about the word he used was the architectonics of the Bible influenced the Book of Mormon, meaning sort of the structure, you know, that it's broken up into different books with chapters and verses. And so it's pretty clear that he didn't know kind of the history of the Book of Mormon text whatsoever. The Book of Mormon resembled the Bible much less textually when it first came out. Yeah, it had books and everything, but it wasn't broken up into verses and all that stuff until later on. So, you know, he wasn't really that familiar. He only mentioned it in passing. My guess is that he would have saw the Book of Mormon as something of a production of Joseph Smith or something that was sort of based on the Bible. That's kind of the impression that you get. But anyway, that's about all. As far as specific things that Lewis said about Mormons, that was pretty much the only thing I could find.
Well, there's that section with Eustace in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader where he mentions that Eustace belongs to a group that wears funny underwear.
I've looked into that. It's actually the Scrubs family, right? He says that they're teetotalers. Lewis couldn't countenance teetotalers. That was like that was a mortal sin to him. And
he's like, Jesus, drink wine. Why don't you? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's pretty much was his argument. But yeah, that's in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, right?
Yep.
He said it. The parents of this insufferable boy in the Dawn Treader were very up-to-date and advanced people. They're vegetarians, non-smokers, teetotalers, and wore a special kind of underclothes. Now, his stepson, Douglas Gresham, was kind of asked about that reference. Was that supposed to be in regards to some sort of religious group? And Gresham said absolutely not. He was certain that at the time, Lewis had mentioned there was this fad for this new kind of string underwear, sort of crocheted underwear, that these what Lewis would call faddists would wear. So that's what it's saying. They're up to date and advanced people. It doesn't refer to Mormons.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. I mean, I could see how people could get that because they're non-smokers, they're teetotalers, and they wear special underclothes. But no, Lewis was referring to these faddists.
We're not that hip.
Yeah, we ain't that hip. We're definitely not cutting edge. So up until today, I think the last time I remember him getting – he's been quoted even recently I know in 2009, Elder Oaks quoted him, and I can't remember specifically beyond that, but he's only a few references ahead of Ralph Waldo Emerson, and Abraham Lincoln's 128 references, I should say. I think I got that number wrong earlier. But still, I mean, that's 100 more than Lewis, so he's got a lot of catching up to do.
Okay, but there is this sense of, you know, handle a little more head on, you know, he's our unofficial...
Yeah, this is funny.
We've sort of baptized him by proxy.
Well, he's probably been proxy baptized.
Well, that's true.
Times by now, literally. But yeah, what we do is we sort of, I call it like truth by congruence or truth by commonality. I think a lot of Mormons have tried to use Lewis to show where Mormons get it right. Like, oh, if C.S. Lewis said it and Mormons say it, then it sort of adds this added cachet, like, oh, he had this hidden insight and he phrased it very well, so it sort of backs us up well. In fact, there have been several books that have been published by LDS authors. One of them was published in 1998 by a fellow named Nathan Jensen, and I don't know him, and if he's listening, I apologize, but your book really wasn't that good. It's called The Restored Gospel According to C.S. Lewis. So, I mean, it's literally just a litany of proof texts. He wasn't careful with Lewis at all. I mean, there's some funny blunders that he makes. He says, here's a quote from his book. He says, this man who, as far as we know, had no substantial contact with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and yet he has filled his writings with precepts and doctrines that are not only true, but most wholly unique to the restored church. That's just simply inaccurate. The unique things that he's referring to aren't unique to Mormonism or C.S. Lewis. In fact, I can actually give you an example from Jansen's book where he's like, it's an obvious error here. He says, how did C.S. Lewis know that pride is the great universal sin as taught explicitly by our past prophet Ezra Taft Benson? Well, my answer to Jensen is that Benson was actually borrowing from Lewis there, or whoever helped him prepare that talk. I mean, he's pretty much lifting a lot of that material straight from Lewis. So the influence isn't going from Mormons to Lewis or from God to both of them. It's going from Lewis directly to the talk of President Benson. So so it's just one of the examples. But we do seem really eager to want to make use of Lewis, and I do think it's this idea of truth by commonality, and that Lewis is such a beloved figure that it's reaffirming to our faith to think that God can sort of work through someone like C.S. Lewis. It sort of reaffirms our faith, and it's been noticed. It hasn't gone unnoticed by others, especially evangelicals are bothered by it, who they're also in the process of sort of trying to adopt Lewis for the most part, and then they'll. It was brought up in Richard Ostling's book about Mormonism, where he says that we pay extraordinary attention to C.S. Lewis, and that most of what he says is perfectly acceptable to us. And that was just, as I talked about earlier, simply a case of Lewis being very ecumenical in the way that he talked about Christianity. So when he talked about something like pride, of course it can be appropriated by Mormons without any kind of proof texting or without any kind of resting from its original intent. I think the only area where that happens is in his discussion of theosis, which I think, Dan, you'll probably get into later on.
Are you talking about it's a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses?
Yeah, so
that one certainly is one that Mormons will perk up for.
Yep, so we'll get into that. But
two of his works, where you see that mere Christianity, you've got similar, but he has a different emphasis where we become little Christs, but it's still much closer to us than most other Christian writers you'll find.
No, it is, but I mean, it's really no different than a lot of the stuff that he's just pulling out of his study of the Church Fathers and stuff. It's actually not incredibly radical. It's still informed by creation from nothing and from an ontological distinction between humans and God. So yeah. I think Dan will probably get more into that. But Mormons try to borrow those money quotes about we live in a society of gods and that sort of thing. So
or the one about how when we see if we were to see a redeemed man now, we would be very tempted to worship him, kind of a thing.
Yeah, right. Which Brigham Young said similar things.
Right.
So it's fun to kind of go through and just find places where he's such a great writer that if we can find him saying something that seems Mormon, it draws us like a magnet. And yeah, and so and his children's stories obviously appeal to adults as well. So there's that whole angle. I mean, the appeal of the Narnia books can't be overstated. I think I look forward to hopefully reading them with my daughter as she grows up.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah.
And Blair, that's one of the things I found really interesting about your essay was just like you're talking about the ecumenical kind of stuff where he's so inclusive and he's drawing people in, and the very title Mere Christianity, where it's this common ground. I think that's very beautiful.
Yeah, he was definitely a common ground theologian, and he took some heat for that as well. I mean, other people sort of looked at his work as this sort of pop theology, a little, it's a little too pat, a little too simple, mere Christianity, right? That's what he wanted to do. And he found value in it for the fact that it could speak to so many different kinds of people. And I think his discussions in the Inklings and with his friends certainly influenced his desire to be accessible to a lot of different kinds of Christians as well. I don't think he would have, personally, I don't think he, if he knew of Mormonism much, I don't know that he would have included us in that family or not. But I know as far as just Protestantism, Catholicism, Anglicanism, and just the basic Christianities with which he was familiar, we were still probably, if he knew anything about us, we were probably still kind of fringy to him. Like how Mormons might think of Jehovah's Witnesses or something.
But he had hope for the non-Christian too. So even if he,
It wouldn't have mattered. Yeah, on a salvational standpoint or a soteriological standpoint, it wouldn't have mattered. I mean, pagans could be saved according to Lewis's, theology based on the idea of the virtuous unbeliever, and so yeah, from a salvational standpoint, it wouldn't have mattered. But I think he would have been irritated by the word of wisdom, certainly. In fact, he made pointed remarks about that kind of a thing, which is sad and interesting because his brother Warney grew up to struggle mightily with being a severe alcoholic, and so it wasn't because he was unfamiliar with the dangers of alcohol. He just believed that it added spice to life if you could use it responsibly. So that was one of the biggest probably departures between Lewis and Mormonism would probably be the word of wisdom. He enjoyed a nice mug of ale, I think.
And there's that moment in Pere Lange where he's arguing with the possessed devil character, and the devil character is making this argument which sounds very much like our idea of the Paul. Where it's a good thing. This is helping us progress. And the devil's making this argument, and Lewis kind of fights against that argument in the book. And so that's very not Mormon. Although he the devil character makes our argument very well, I thought.
Yeah. See, and he was willing to. He definitely played. Could play the devil's advocate through many of his characters as well, and literally, right? I mean, he the Screwtape Letters is the devil's advocate. Letters, right? So that's one thing that he repeatedly would sort of remind readers. There's a quote from one of his letters where someone's writing to him about his atonement theory in the Narnia book, The Last Battle. He has Aslan sort of, gives himself as ransom to the witch, right, in the place of one or all the children. It's been too long since I remembered it. But anyway,
Edmund,
right. So he responds to this correspondent. He says, "You must not confuse my romances with my theses. In the latter, I state and argue a creed. In the former, much is merely supposed for the sake of the story itself." So you'll find theological elements in his fiction through the Space Trilogy and through Narnia and Screwtape Letters, and basically whenever he's making a theological point in his fiction, he did kind of want people to keep in mind that he was playing with ideas there. He was, and that's why they're you can't systematize them. There are contradictions there, and he recognized that. And
yeah, one of the things on the Narnia, at the end of the Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe, he basically uses the ransom theory of the atonement, but in his other writings, he's saying, I have no clue how the atonement works.
Yeah.
That I'm holding to this particular one, what matters is that Christ changes you, become at one, you know.
He would even sort of say that atonement theories are sort of like useful fictions. You know, he would say, look, even if you have it pretty close to being right, there's still something that transcends it in the way that the atonement works out. So yeah, there's the fact that he believed that it worked was much more important than the way that he couched it, and he would really try to make that clear. And I think that's probably where Mormons could do really well, seeking a parallel there with Lewis. And we have, you know, we have some pretty basic ideas about how the atonement worked. You have Elder President Packer's the mediator type parable, and then we have different sort of theories that you can tease out of the Doctrine and Covenants. But when you get down to the brass tacks, I think most Mormons would probably agree that you don't have to intellectually understand the atonement in order to partake of its blessings, right? So there's this idea that underneath such considerations, being the right type of person, having a relationship with God, transcends theological specificity for Lewis. So I think that's where Mormons have kind of an affinity with Lewis, is on his views that proper action in life is more important than having all of your theological ducks in a row.
Exactly.
Although I would say that it would be less for Lewis proper action in life and more the sort of transformed heart, the heart in the right place.
Well, I was about to say the action is the surrender to God. Because when we talked earlier about when he's getting teased for, you know, it's mere Christianity, and he's getting the grief, like, because of the people wanting to press particular angles on it and stuff like that. Holy heck, this dude's Christianity is serious business, and he comes as close to anybody. That's what I find him so powerful, is the old South has to die. You know, even in the Don Treader, Eustace character, he gets turned into a dragon, and he wants to get off this dragon skin, right. And he tries to take it off himself, and he keeps peeling off a layer, and he jumps in there, and he still sees that he's a dragon, and finally Aslan says, I've got to do it. You know, the Christ character, you cannot take this thing off yourself, and you have to be willing to submit. There's a wonderful thing in The Great Divorce where there's this little red lizard on this ghost's shoulder, and he keeps whispering to him about all the lustful things that were in his life before, and this angel character comes up to him and says, let me kill it. You know, you need to kill us. Oh, we don't need to go that far. Da, da, da. You know, when he says, you know, if you're going to pick a religion that you want to feel good and happy and stuff about it, don't pick Christianity, because what we're talking about here is radical surrender.
Yep.
Yeah, well, that the title, The Great Divorce, is sort of about that, being able to divest yourself of or being willing to be divested of things that you care about the most, even about yourself, or
right.
when you have the wrong priorities. The Great Divorce is the separation between heaven and hell. I think it's you know, he's doing a take on Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which was this idea that you could combine the two, which is probably a bit more Joseph Smithy than the Great Divorce idea, I think. But yeah, that's kind of the road he's going. But then, you know, he does the thing about the pair of scissors. Grace versus works is more like a pair of scissors, where you need both. You know, both sides of the scissors in order to make a good cut. So
it's very Nephi right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So he's going to, one of the main reasons why his books didn't go into Christian living as much as they did the idea of being converted to begin with is just because he had come to Christianity so late in life. After he wrote The Pilgrim's Regress, people kind of asked, well, why did it kind of stop after the guy became a Christian? And he said, well, it's because I just became a Christian and I have no idea what to write next. And so he was still sort of trying to figure out this ongoing discipleship was still something that Lewis worked on, in addition to this idea that there was a letting go and there was God coming into your life in a way that you might not have even wanted or expected. So there's tension there in Lewis's theology. It's not quite so clear cut, I think, either way.
Yeah. And Katie, I'm sorry if I cut you off when you're talking about the transformation. It was just when you said the act is not as important as the transformation. To me, that was that act of surrender. But did you have a larger point to make that I stepped on? I apologize.
No. And I think your distinction there is very apt. I have a little bit more about this to talk, you know, that I to talk about later. I don't know if you want me to dive into it now, but
I mean, that pretty much wraps up what I was, as far as like the Mormons and Lewis thing. That's
okay. So yeah. So he's not as huge a towering, you know, the most quoted guy. So we've got that, and we can tell why we would do it. But none of us are at least on this panel, are really in that mode of, oh, we're just trying to use him to bolster ourselves.
Right.
It just seems like he would just be in the air. He'd be well read by anybody who reads spiritual things, and naturally, at some point in the general authorities' lives, who you know, eventually mention him in a talk. These images and these phrases will come to them, and they'll just use them. But there's no real attempt to like make him our 13th apostle.
Right. Right. I think just my main takeaway from all the work I did was that rather than having Lewis just be a source for proof texts that sort of conform to what Mormons believe, I came to the conclusion that Lewis should actually be more like a gateway drug, you know, to get you thinking more about theology and then keep going.
Awesome. Yeah. You
know, yeah.
And we get that with Terrell and Fiona Givens lately, with where they've taken a page from Lewis and applied it to Mormonism and used him as, and they quote him a few times in The God Who Weeps. But to me, he and Fiona are like the new C.S. Lewis for us. You know, we don't have to always have to harken back to C.S. Lewis. We've got very capable people in the church right now who are taking a very similar role.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, and even in way different veins, you got Adam Miller sort of doing theological projects that are sort of new and unique for Mormonism. He's not exactly in the Lewis strain of things, but he's this sort of thinker, sort of could be that sort of a figure for Mormons who want to delve more deeply into it. But yeah, I agree.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Blair, for that. And thanks, Mahanrai, for the earlier section. Is there anything about his life that we need to bring up before we can kind of... What I want to lead us into is not a critique. I just want to draw a couple of distinctions between Mormon theology and the theology he was based on. But then I really mostly want us just to have fun with what we love and, you know, what we want to point out to people in case they want to read.
I think just one more point on his life, just for the sake of wrapping that aspect up, he passed away in 1963 of renal failure. He was actually still pretty young. And one of the reasons it didn't get a lot of press at the time is because it was actually the same day that Kennedy died. Yeah, and JFK was shot. Oh. So
and also, was it Huxley or somebody else too? Yeah,
Huxley
it was like
died
three.
That same day. All three of them.
Yeah. It was a day for a lot of people. So.
I had no idea. That's crazy.
And it was like a week before his 65th birthday, I think it was.
Yeah. He still was pretty young.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good to know. Yeah, and it was just a very short. I guess he had known he had some kidney problems, but when he got sick and died, it was pretty quick, if I remember right. So.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.